Kids Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we're continuing our Hidden Wisconsin series, and we'll be speaking with Milwaukee's most famous cab driver.
And while he may be hard at work, many federal government workers around the country are still at home as we near the third day of the federal government shutdown.
Among those at home are many of the Food and Drug Administration's food inspectors, along with those who track and prevent foodborne illness at the Centers for Disease Control.
And that means a lot of the food that we find in grocery stores is going uninspected while the government remains shuttered. Here with us to talk about the impact of these furloughs is political reporter Tarini Parti. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
It is good to have you along. I want to start with some of the basics right now. There are several agencies that are involved in food inspections. So if you could bring us up on the agencies that are involved and then which workers within those agencies are we talking about here?
Sure. It is complicated to figure out which agency monitors what. But the basic breakdown here is that the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, is responsible for about 80% of the food supply. So that's basically everything except for meat. Meat and poultry is inspected by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. There's a small agency within it called Food Safety Inspection Services, which monitors meat. And while those inspectors remain on the job, most of the FDA inspectors are actually not at work. The FDA is operating on a 55% staff level, and the CDC, which is the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, that actually tracks these diseases with its surveillance system, is operating on a 32% staff level, which was described as a skeletal staff to us.
And let's talk about the food inspections. Let's start with that angle of all this. Obviously, we're only looking at day three of the federal shutdown, so we may not have seen a lot of the impacts of this yet. But those who advocate for food safety, what are their concerns when we're talking about this? Are we going to start seeing these effects in a week or two? Is food still going to be showing up in our grocery stores?
Well, the impact really is, on a day-to-day basis is unclear. The biggest concern is that if this thing drags out, if the shutdown drags out, what happens if there's actually an illness outbreak? That's what the biggest concern is right now. We saw that several members of Congress, a few senators, spoke on the floor today, really advocating for some sort of funding for these agencies so that, these workers who so far have not been deemed essential, can come back to work.
And so, and if we get to the point where there is an outbreak of some kind, that really is where the CDC comes in.
Exactly. So, they're responsible for monitoring what are called clusters of foodborne outbreaks. Right now, they told us there are 30 of these clusters. Obviously, not all of them, are going to turn into big outbreaks, but there are monitoring 30, what they call 30 clusters, and they're doing that with a very limited staff.
So in the meantime, are grocery stores still receiving food? Are restaurants still receiving food? And is this food in large part uninspected?
Restaurants and grocery stores will still be receiving food. The only difference is that the FDA, which is going to be responsible for most of that food, isn't giving it the last look over before it goes out. But, most companies obviously want to make sure that their products that are going out there are safe. So when the government shuts down, they're taking probably, more responsibility to make sure that their products are safe because, they don't want an outbreak on their hands.
And to put things in perspective, when the inspectors are fully staffed at the FDA and at the USDA, they don't inspect all of the food all of the time right now, right?
You're exactly right. And a part of that reason is that, these agencies are strapped for funding already. Even when the government is funding these agencies, they have limited money. And so they're not inspecting every single thing that goes out there. But the fact that the companies have someone watching over them and there is, a threat that the FDA could inspect them keeps things moving, supposedly keeps things safe.
Now, you said a few minutes ago that there were some members of Congress who have been speaking out in favor of restoring some of this funding for some of these positions. Given that, I imagine there are lots of members of Congress making lots of speeches like that right now. How was this particular angle received?
Well, you know, food safety is something that everyone can connect to. It's a very real issue, and which is why a lot of the meat inspectors are still on the job. You know, FSIS, the agency I mentioned earlier, still it has 87% of its staff, which is, you know, much more than any other agency, or much more than a lot of the other agencies have. So it's something that, you know, other members can connect to, their constituents, voters, can connect to, and it is an important issue, especially with CDC only having 32% of their staff.
Now, if something does happen, an outbreak of some kind or an incident of some kind, what's the game plan then? Does the FDA or CDC have plans in place to call people back to work or to respond in some fashion?
Well, it's unclear what their game plan is right now. I know from the people that we've spoken to, you know, typically, you know, there are people on the state level and federal level that work together in times of an outbreak. So, you know, the state agencies will be ready to go. Obviously, there are still some people on the federal level who are still going to work, and they'll be able to respond. But of the people that we talked to said we're just keeping our fingers crossed to make sure nothing bad happens.
And of those people you've talked to, as we know, you know, we're nearing day three, so we're not very far into this thing. Is there a point at which they are really worried about things, or are they really worried about things right now?
I think they are worried right now, but it's really the long term that is scary. You know, a few days is fine, but when we start getting into weeks here, that's when the real problems could start.
And as we look ahead, do you see any long-term impacts of this? You know, one of the things many people don't think about is food being inspected and people making sure that the food supply is safe. And then what happens when there's an outbreak? Do you think there's any chance that once this is all over with, that there'll be some sort of long-term effect on FDA or USDA that people might argue for more funding for these organizations?
Well, it's unclear, and you know, the FDA actually is getting ready to implement a major food safety overhaul, and they've been pushing for more funding for that because, you know, their budget has been getting cut repeatedly, and but with this Congress, it's, you know, really hard to get money for any program, so food safety being one of them. So, you know, it's unclear what the long-term impact is going to be. You know, it just depends on if, you know, if there's an outbreak, obviously that issue becomes more in the forefront of members of Congress. And, you know, it creates a more dire need for funds. But, you know, at this point, it's really hard to say if they're going to get more funding.
But I imagine if something does happen, there will be plenty of fingers being pointed.
Exactly.
Now, one of the things you mentioned just a second or two ago is the FDA is already planning for a major overhaul of some of the food safety regs. Tell me a little bit about that.
So it's the Food Safety Modernization Act that was passed just a few years ago. They're still trying to figure out how to implement it. You know, with these agencies, it's a long process, rulemaking and comment period. So it's still being worked out. But, you know, it's a really, really expensive overhaul. And the agency is still, you know, doesn't have enough funds. So they've been pushing for more funding for the past few years now. And but, you know, things are looking tough with this Congress.
And so if we are to see change, do you expect, I mean, obviously it's got to get through Congress and all that, but within a year or two, we might see some sort of tougher regulations actually being implemented as opposed to just being talked about?
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, it's still, like I said, in the process, in the rulemaking process, it's not all finalized yet, but, you know, Congress did pass it back in 2010, and the president signed it, I think it was January of 2011. So, you know, it will be implemented in the near future.
Well, Tarini Party, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
We've been speaking with political reporter Tarini Party about what the government shutdown means for food inspections.
Now we'll check the headlines, and then we'll be back with our next installment of Hidden Wisconsin. On with us today is one of Milwaukee's most famous cabbies. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
And it's time for another edition of Hidden Wisconsin, where we talk to people who do the jobs that make Wisconsin work.
A cab driver, well, it's a city's unsung ambassador, the first resident a visitor encounters, for better or worse.
Rory Orgill drives his cab 7 nights a week in Milwaukee, and he's been at it for a long time. Rory, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you very much. I'm honored, and it's a pleasure to be on your show.
Well, and it's nice to be talking to you, too, now. 7 nights a week for how many years are we talking about here?
You know, it's been so long, I've kind of lost track now, but I'm guessing probably 15, 16 years. And it's usually 7 nights a week. Occasionally I do take some time off, maybe on a slower night like a Monday or Tuesday. But it's almost easier to keep the 7-night-a-week schedule because of the crazy hours you work. If you take a night off, it tends to throw your body clock off, so it's almost easier to keep the same schedule night after night.
Yeah, let's talk about those crazy hours for a second. When do you start, and typically, when do you stop?
Well, I usually start, I have the cab from 6 o'clock at night till 6 in the morning, so it's a 12-hour shift, and when I was a bit younger, I would work all 12 hours, and now that I'm getting a bit older, I find myself working still maybe 10 hours a day, but not quite the 12. Unless it's very busy out there. So it's a long shift, but you have your freedom, and, you know, if things are slow, you can go home and take a break or take a nap in the cab. So you have some flexibility, which is nice.
Well, let's ask you some of the questions that probably everybody asks the longtime cab driver. Any famous fares, any celebrities you've hauled around Milwaukee?
Oh, yeah. There's been so many, it's hard to... hard to remember them all. Probably the most famous person I had in the cab was, and this is a number of years ago, probably when I first started, was actually when cell phones first came out. So that was probably, you know, when cell phones were common, so almost 15 plus years ago. But I have a lot of bartenders and waitresses that are regular riders, and one of my bartenders called and said, would you like to pick up Larry Bird?
Wow.
And I thought she was joking, and I showed up, and sure enough, there was Larry Bird. And drove him and his friend around the city. They were kind of bar hopping. This is back when he was coaching Indiana,
okay,
or Indianapolis, the Pacers. And super nice guy. He paid double whatever the fare was, so big tipper. And he was all right. I had Jim Gaffigan, the comedian.
Uh-huh.
You're probably familiar with him. Tracy Morgan, after he did a Summerfest gig. That was about 10 years ago. John Fishman, the drummer from the band Fish. Actually, his whole band was in the cab. I picked him up at picked up these five guys at a restaurant in Milwaukee, and I said, "Where are you guys heading to?" And they said, "We're going to the Rave, which is a music venue here in Milwaukee." And I said, "Oh, great! Who's playing?" And they said, "We are, and we're late." And so I kind of went through my mental calendar as to who was playing, and realized who it was, and started asking a few questions, and John Fishman, the drummer for Fish, was one of the members of the band. So picked up lots of musicians, the band Gomez from England, which not a lot of people know about, but they were very nice. Sammy Lannis from the Bodines. I'm sure everyone's familiar with the Bodines. And a lot of baseball players, but since I don't really follow baseball, I couldn't tell you who they were, which is terrible.
Now, I imagine most of the people you pick up, though, aren't particularly famous, but, you know, everybody has a personality. And so from your perspective, what works out best for you? Somebody who gets in the back, because I've been in both situations. Sometimes I get in the back of a cab and I feel real chatty. And other times I just kind of want to be by myself. From your perspective, which do you like better?
Well, it depends on the time of day. If it's nighttime, usually I'm picking up younger kids and taking them to the bars, and they're chatty, or they'll start firing off a million questions. What's your most exciting ride? Who have you had in the cab? Tell us some stories. And they want to know what's going on, and that's fine. Usually in the morning, if you're taking someone to the airport, they've just woken up, they've got business on their mind, they're still groggy from, you know, just getting out of bed. And I might ask a couple questions, and sometimes you find that they're very chatty, and other times, you know, with a few questions, you can tell they just want to be left alone. And so, you know, I just keep to myself, and that's about it. So you shoot off a couple questions, and you can figure it out pretty quick after all these years.
We said up front, cab drivers are kind of the unsung ambassadors of a place. What, when you're picking up people, say, at the airport, just coming into town, what do you want them to know about Milwaukee?
Well, there's... kind of complicated, but there's two different types of cabs. There's cabs that sit at the airport that pick people up at the airport. I can take people to the airport, but I can't pick them up. But I do pick up a lot of people from the hotels. And it's the impression that a lot of people get, they don't know what to expect from Milwaukee if they've never been here before. They think Laverne and Shirley. They think Happy Days. They think what they've seen on TV. And they're impressed by the architecture. They're impressed by the cuisine. We have a lot of great restaurants in Milwaukee.
True.
They're impressed by the cleanliness, which is something you don't notice unless you go to a different city, that Milwaukee really is a very clean city. And we've preserved a lot of our architecture, and people comment on that all the time when I pick them up. Sometimes people want to go for a little ride and want to see some of the historic sites and want to see some of the big homes on Lake Drive, and I'm happy to take them for a ride and give them as much information as I can about the history of Milwaukee that I know.
One of the things that I've noticed lately is that things seem to be changing in the world of taxi cabs, and I'm wondering what you think the future of taxi cabs look like. And I'm thinking of, you know, some of the apps like Uber and some of those ride-sharing cars, you know, the ones with the pink mustaches and so forth. Is there a future for a good old taxi cab?
I think there'll always be taxi cabs in Milwaukee. Milwaukee's not really a cab town and never has been. It's not a Chicago. It's not a New York. But there's always a need for cabs. Milwaukee is a big drinking town, and a lot of people take advantage of the cabs when they go out during the week or on the weekends, which is a good thing because, you know, Milwaukee has too many people drinking and driving, and more people should take cabs. So I think there'll always be cabs in the city.
Well, because of drinking or otherwise, have you had a lot of backseat dramas unfold? Kind of people forget that there's somebody in earshot and have an argument or something like that.
Oh, you after 16 years driving, I've heard it all, seen it all. There's really not a lot that can shock me. And you hear arguments and you hear fights and you hear things that shouldn't be repeated and certainly aren't NPR appropriate.
Thank you for that.
I could tell you a lot of stories. But it's interesting. It's different every day, which is one of the things that I like about it. You're doing the same thing every day, but every day is different. You get different people in the car every day. You're dealing with different people. Some are very nice. A lot are not very nice, especially at bar time. But you learn to deal with it and continue on.
And does it ever get dangerous for you?
Well, in the when I was younger... And I guess I was a risk taker and looking for adventure. And I would go anywhere, anytime, any call. But you realize if you're looking for excitement, you're going to find it. And every city has its dark side. And in the first couple of years, I got shot at three times. And it wasn't specifically at me. It was just being at the wrong place at the wrong time. And a couple bullets hit the cab.
Wow.
But that's... That'll keep you up better than a Red Bull or a cup of coffee. You take the bullet to the quarter panel, let me tell you.
Oof. Well, on a happier note, you mentioned every now and then you do take some breaks from that 7-night-a-week schedule. What do you do for fun? I'm going to guess it's not go for a long drive, but maybe I'm wrong.
Well, I do one of two things. I have a girlfriend in Chicago, so if I do take a night off, I do take a long drive and go down and visit her. Quite often I go to as many concerts as I can, if that's available. And a lot of times I'll go to concerts while I'm working and then just hop in the cab right after the show. And, you know, you're the first cab there because you just left the show and, you know, people are coming out. So it works out quite well.
And now this is a loaded question. What do you listen to in the cab?
Oh boy, what do I listen to? It's
Wisconsin Public Radio.
Wisconsin Public Radio. Yeah,
well done, sir.
So I listen to 89.7 here in Milwaukee.
Mm-hmm, sure.
Generally, don't listen to you guys, but I do listen to NPR probably most of the time. I have an iPod in the car and listen to a lot of music that way, which is good. But I'm definitely a big NPR fan, that's for sure.
All right. So I think something a lot of us who only occasionally ride cabs want to know, what's the right etiquette for tipping a cab driver?
Well, you know, that's a difficult question. You know, some people don't know to tip at all, and usually they're kids, and that's fine, and they don't know, and I don't say anything about it. Some people go by a 10 or 20% rule. If it's a short ride, you know, a couple bucks. If you're going cross town... it should probably be a little bit, you know, $5-6 or whatever would be more appropriate. I'm not so focused on that, though. I just want to make sure people have a good experience in the cab. And the tips are nice, but it's not the most important thing.
All right, Rory, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
All right,
we'll
see you on the road. Thanks a lot.
All righty, very good. Thanks again.
That was Milwaukee cabbie Rory Orgill.
And don't forget, if you'd like to be a guest on Hidden Wisconsin, or if you've got someone in mind, give our hotline a call at 855-6833-5422.
I typed it wrong, Gene.
Lots of numbers there. Let me do this again. 855-683-5422 and leave a message.
That makes more sense. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, biologist Richard Dawkins joins the show to talk about his life and career as a scientist.
And we'll talk to education expert Diane Ravitch about her new book, Criticizing the Privatization of Schools.
In our Food Friday segment, we've got a chili expert. He'll tell us how to win that chili cook-off.
And that's all coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll hear about the politics behind the proposed Keystone XL pipeline, which would carry oil from Canada to refineries in Texas. I'm Gene Purcell.
I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.
I said, hey,
hey,
Milwaukee,
Milwaukee,
Milwaukee is all right with me. I said, hey,
hey,
Milwaukee.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. When President Obama spoke at his second inauguration, he said that the failure to combat global warming would betray our children and future generations.
It's a strong statement, but there's a lot of environmentalists unhappy with President Obama and his record on climate change while he's been focusing on jobs and the economy.
Ryan Lizza is a Washington correspondent for The New Yorker. In a recent piece, he suggests that the ultimate test of Obama's resolve on climate change could be his decision on the Keystone XL pipeline. The project needs both presidential and State Department approval.
Ryan Liz is here with us to discuss what the pipeline means to the Obama presidency and environmentalists who backed him in the elections. Ryan, thanks for joining us.
Hey, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's look back at this Keystone XL pipeline. First, give us a reminder of what it is.
Well, the Keystone XL pipeline is a oil pipeline that would take crude oil from Alberta, Canada, right near Calgary, and basically connect it with some existing pipelines, which are also confusingly known as Keystone. And this new leg of the Keystone system would allow Canada to very quickly export about 830,000 barrels a day to the Gulf of Mexico, where there are just about more refining capacity for oil than any place in the world. So the big problem for the Canadians is they have this major, major oil resource that's essentially landlocked, and they need more pipeline capacity to get it out of Canada, get it refined, and get it on the world market. And the Keystone XL would really solve that problem for them.
And you write that at one point this was pretty much a done deal. It was just going to happen. How did it go from there to a huge controversy and a question mark at the end of it?
I mean, not just a huge controversy, but probably the biggest environmental issue of the moment, right? It really came about because there was a vacuum in climate change policy after Obama's third year in office. Once Republicans took over the House and increased their margins in the Senate in 2011, Obama really didn't talk about climate change anymore. And his original legislation to deal with climate change, the cap and trade bill, that had died in 2010. In 2011, he was left with a decision to put in place some regulations through the EPA, because he didn't have a legislative solution to deal with carbon pollution, and he didn't do it. And a lot of environmentalists were waiting for him to do something on climate change, either propose some new legislation or move forward with EPA regulations. And basically people started getting a little antsy and thought, what's going on here? This president is abandoning this issue that he campaigned on. And I think that that's where the Keystone Pipeline, it sort of filled a vacuum. And some smart environmentalists realized a couple of things. One, that this area in Canada known as the oil sands, this issue is so controversial that there's not even a settled name for this place. The government and the industry call it the oil sands. The environmentalists call it the tar sands. There are some climate scientists who look at these sort of unconventional sources of oil, essentially this is oil in the ground that's mixed with sand, and you have to get it out to extract the oil. It takes a lot of energy. So that means more carbon is used to extract it than, say, oil in Saudi Arabia that's just sort of sitting there. And some climate scientists, some very famous ones, said if we start burning up all the unconventional oil in the world, we are doomed. In fact, James Hansen, a famous climate scientist, said it would be game over for the environment. And so some activists realized they wanted to do everything they could to slow down the exploitation of the oil sands. And they realized that this pipeline, this Canadian pipeline company, TransCanada, was proposing might be a way to slow down the exploitation of the oil sands. And then they learned that, oh, by the way, President Obama has to approve this pipeline. And so a campaign was born to defeat or to get President Obama to not approve the permit from Canada to build this pipeline that would arguably increase the production of the oil sands and contribute to global warming in a much bigger way than if the pipeline wasn't built.
A big part of your piece is spent talking to environmentalists, including some wealthy supporters of President Obama and the Democratic Party. Do they feel conflicted? They support the president. They helped get him elected, and yet they're very unhappy with the possibility of Keystone XL, this pipeline, becoming a reality.
Well, one of the situations you have in the Democratic Party is that there's a very wealthy donor class that lives on the coasts, and there's a set of issues that a lot of them have in common, and one of them really is the environment. And so Obama has sort of been used to, when he goes to fundraisers, he is very often, this is the issue he hears the most about. And so one of the fundraisers that I write about is a guy named Tom Steyer. Now, Tom Steyer made a fortune as a running a hedge fund. It's worth between $1 and $2 billion at least. And he sort of recently gave up his hedge fund and is devoting himself full-time to politics and full-time to the politics of climate change and trying to do something to get the political system to address climate change. And lo and behold, one of his first targets happens to be the president of the United States, the guy who he's raised a lot of money for, to the point where Steyer actually was asked by Nancy Pelosi, the Democratic the minority leader of the House of Representatives, to do a fundraiser earlier this year at his house in San Francisco. And Steyer said, you know, I'll do the fundraiser. And he was told that the president was going to come to this fundraiser. He said, I'll do the fundraiser, but I want to turn the fundraiser into essentially a lobbying meeting about Keystone. And he arranged it so he had about himself and his wife and about 10 other very wealthy donors had a private meeting with Obama at this fundraiser where they really pressed him on Keystone and asked him to not approve the pipeline. And so Steyer has sort of, through the help, Steyer is one of many people who care a lot about the environment, care a lot about climate change, who have sort of made Keystone their signature issue.
On the other hand, there's pressure on the jobs and economic front. Republicans, and not just Republicans, have made the case for the pipeline, saying, hey, any energy helps bring fuel costs down, and this will boost jobs at the refineries and along the way. Is that part of what puts the president in a bind here?
It is. You know, there are two arguments on this thing. On the pro pipeline side, there's the jobs argument. I mean, really, the pressure for the pipeline comes from the producers in Canada, the folks who have an incredibly rich resource, right? You know, literally hundreds of millions of barrels of oil in the oil sands of Canada, and they have a problem. They need to get it to market. So that's where the real pressure for the pipeline comes. But as they started to make their argument here in the States, they've pushed this idea that this would lead to a lot of American jobs. This is a big infrastructure project. It's hundreds of miles of laying pipe. On the other side, the environmentalists, their key argument is, you have to stop this pipeline because it will significantly contribute to greenhouse gas emissions. Now, there have been a lot of people that have looked at both of these claims, and it's the job of the State Department right now to really sort through the competing claims on each side. And I don't think it's as easy as one thinks to figure out who's right on those. but I tend to think that both sides are exaggerating. In other words, the jobs argument, the last projection the State Department did, basically they argued that long term there would only be a few dozen sort of permanent jobs after an initial burst of activity building the pipeline. You know, it doesn't take a whole lot to sort of maintain it once it's built. On the environmental side, it's very tricky to figure out if you build this pipeline, will it make global warming worse or not? Because the issue all comes down to, will these Canadian oil companies and international oil companies that are exploiting the oil sands, will they be able to get their product to market absent the Keystone XL? And so when you start doing a market analysis and look at the other methods they have available to them, can they ship it to their coasts via other pipelines? Can they ship it to the Gulf coast of the United States via rail, which seems like a promising alternative? Maybe in the end it's all a wash. And from what I've been able to figure out, that's Obama's opinion on this. He has said privately that he thinks the jobs argument is exaggerated, and he thinks the greenhouse gas emissions argument on the Keystone is exaggerated. And it's up to the State Department to sort of sort that out and present the president with some objective numbers about those arguments. And that State Department finding will come out in a matter of weeks, maybe months. Everyone sort of who pays attention to this debate is sort of waiting for it. And then Obama will have that report or be able to use that report to make his final decision on this.
We're talking to Ryan Lizza. He's Washington correspondent for The New Yorker. We're talking about the Keystone XL pipeline. He wrote a big piece about this, about the politics behind it, what environmentalists think, what the Obama administration thinks, and everyone else, too. What do you think? You can join in at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You can also send an email, talk@WPR.org, or post at our Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
We'll pick up our conversation now with Ryan Lizza. He's Washington correspondent for The New Yorker, wrote a piece on the politics of the Keystone XL pipeline. We'll get to your calls in a few minutes at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Send an email to talk@WPR.org. Ryan's with us for about 5 more minutes, and then it'll be your turn to sound off. What do you think of the issue? What are your thoughts and opinions? Ryan, are all environmentalists as hot on this issue as the ones we've been talking about, or are there some scratching their heads and saying, we've got other stuff we should be dealing with, the Keystone Pipeline isn't the big thing we should worry about?
That's a really great question, because it has divided environmentalists, especially early on. The movement really got off the ground through the efforts of Bill McKibben, a former writer for my magazine, actually, The New Yorker, who left the sort of world of journalism to become a full-time activist and now lives in Vermont. He really started organizing this campaign in an intense way a few years ago. There had been local groups, both in Canada and in Nebraska and other places where the pipeline was along the route of the pipeline, that had been opposed to Keystone, but he really turned it into a major climate change issue. And he, you know, as I said before, he did that at a point when there really wasn't a whole lot going on in climate change policy, and people needed something in the environmental community, or the environmental community was looking for something to rally around. But there are people who think that it's far more important to push the Obama administration on aggressive EPA regulations that would do something about power plant emissions and the sort of major domestic sources of greenhouse gas emissions.
Well, let's pursue that, because the EPA just made an announcement related to that in the last couple of weeks, didn't it?
Exactly. And I think, you know, one of the things I tried to do when I was writing the story is push some of the major environmentalists and say, which would you rather have? Would you rather have Keystone killed, or would you rather have these EPA power plant regulations? Now, these regulations haven't been officially written yet, so we don't know how aggressive they're going to be. But there are plenty of people, plenty of environmentalists, who would say that they would rather have the EPA regulations than Keystone. One of the arguments that the environmentalists have about Keystone, the ones that are not sold necessarily on the fact that this will lead, that killing Keystone will necessarily lead to a decrease in greenhouse gas emissions. You know, some of them argue quite persuasively that there's a symbolic benefit to this fight, that if the president were to stand up on the world stage and say, this is not who the United States is as a country. We don't want to be exploiting unconventional oil anymore. And he used it as an opportunity to sort of express how the U.S. sees its own energy future. That there could be a certain benefit to that, and especially as he his presidency ends and he starts to think about a international treaty to address global warming. That's one argument I ran into quite a bit. Including from at least one former senior Obama administration official who wants him to kill Keystone.
You mentioned in your piece, and we mentioned at the outset of our conversation, that President Obama talked about combating climate change in his second inaugural address. How is that playing out in his mind? Not that you can read his mind, but as he looks forward to his legacy on climate change, is the Keystone Pipeline weighing large? These EPA emissions controls? Or is he looking for a bigger reverse carbon footprint, I guess?
It's a tough thing to get at, but from what I could tell from the people that know him and know these issues well, is that early in this campaign against Keystone, he was not. Certainly not bought into the environmentalists' arguments, and if the decision had been made, say, a year ago, this thing was sort of cruising towards approval. Now, there were some messy politics that got in the way of things in 2012 when Republicans passed some legislation that required the president to make an immediate decision on Keystone. That sort of backfired on the supporters of Keystone because the State Department said, hey, we don't have enough time to review this, so we recommend that the president not approve the permit. And that's what happened, and it sort of took the issue away for the 2012 campaign. What happened after that was that the movement, the activists, used that delay as a real opportunity to sort of build their movement. They did lots of campaigns in front of the White House, including mass arrests, and to the point where now it's going to be much harder for the president, now that the company has submitted a new application, it's going to be a little bit harder for the president to do what he probably wanted to do initially, which is approve the pipeline. So, the activists, I quote one person in the article, a guy named John Podesta, is a former chief of staff to Bill Clinton and a close White House advisor in this White House. And he is against the Keystone Pipeline. And, he argued that this issue had moved from 90% certainty that Obama would approve the pipeline to about 50-50.
Well, we'll leave it there. Ryan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
That was Ryan Lizza. He's a Washington correspondent for The New Yorker. We've been talking about the Keystone Pipeline proposal with him and the controversy over it. Now it's your turn. You can join in with your thoughts for the next few minutes at 800-642-1234. If you encounter a busy phone line, you can try again, or you can email talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org, or head over to Central Time on WPR on Facebook. We'll go to the phones now. We have Gene calling up from Louisiana. Gene, hi. Welcome to the show.
Yes, sir. I'll do it.
All right. So what do you think about this?
Well, the oil sands out of Canada have actually been coming into this country since 1968. I'm presently working on a project dealing with a pipeline that's been carrying this oil since 1968. It's nothing new. And there are other lines other than the Keystone that are actually carrying this oil now. And have been. The Keystone XL is the north-south portion of it. In 2009, we laid the east-west spurs of this Keystone project, and the idea is not just to carry oil out of Canada, but to also carry oil from the Bakken oil field in North Dakota, which is now being shipped by rail. And by the way, that rail, all the rail cars that derailed in Canada and obliterated that town, that was Bakken oil field oil. That had to be shipped by rail because that's how they have to get it out there.
Gotcha. Thanks a lot, Gene, for calling up and sharing that perspective. We'll go now to Carl. Carl's on the line in Madison. Hi, Carl.
Yes, hello. Thank you for having the program, and I congratulate the author on an excellent article in The New Yorker. I read it, and for anyone who's interested in the history of this issue and why Keystone XL has become such a big symbol, it's a great source to explore. I have to strongly disagree with the last caller. Partly it's the symbolism of, if we're going to draw the line somewhere, why not draw it in this case, where we have a pipeline that's on the national consciousness. We've got tar sands coming out of Canada that are going to be mucked through an aquifer into, you know, be shipped internationally. It's not going to make us energy independent. Keystone cannot be built. Carbon in the form of oil and coal and existing corporate reserves would quadruple the warming of the planet. It can't be burned. So it's no longer a political argument any more than the fact that my kids need food to eat and air to breathe is a political argument. You know, folks have been arrested. I'm a member of 350.org. I'm also a member of the Citizens Climate Lobby. And folks have been arrested in Washington and elsewhere all over the country to bring attention to this issue. But now Mother Nature, you know, in various forms, is doing this attention-getting for us. And I strongly suggest that people should really read the science, really understand not just what Keystone XL would pipe down south, but what it represents in terms of the direction our country turns toward energy independence through sustainable, clean forms of energy, or back circularly toward a non-sustainable and ultimately, extinction model that we're under now.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call, Carl. Two different perspectives from Gene and Carl there. We've got Steele on the line in Appleton. Hi, Steele.
Hey, everybody. Yeah, I was just curious. For years, there's always been discussions on refineries and the people that live around it on the Texas, Louisiana, Alabama coasts. If Canada has all this oil, why don't they make their own refineries?
Gotcha. That's an interesting question, Steele, and that's something we can pursue on a future show. Thanks a lot for the call. We'll go now to Lynn with us in Eau Claire. Hi, Lynn.
Good afternoon. And in answer to Steele, my father worked at an oil refinery just south of Chicago on the Kalsit Canal. And they're not benign places. I lost a child. I miscarried due to a chemical spill, and I carry asbestos in my lungs for the rest of my life, as do my siblings. It's not benign. There are dire consequences that individuals pay for so-called cheap energy.
All right. Thanks for the call. Lynn, we've got time for one more call from Ned in Wausau. Ned, hi.
Hi. Among the other things, besides what the earlier caller said from 350.org, in addition to that, the oil from the oiled tar sands oil is very, very thick, and it requires a lot higher pressure to go through the pipeline. And if that thick oil goes through the proposed new pipeline, the probability of finding a weak seam at a weld along the way is very high, and we don't really have the technology for cleaning up an oil spill with this very, very thick oil. It just doesn't exist.
Gotcha. Thanks a lot to Ned for the call, to all of you for calling in, and to Ryan Lizza of The New Yorker.
Coming up next is the news, and then we'll be back to rate how well the media has been doing with its coverage of the federal government shutdown. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.